let's work on the questions, I think, and see what we can do to make them more exact. I always feel we make more progress when we get better at asking questions than we do at getting the answers. And it's obvious you've had to do some work to make precise that question. How can the minority churches continue or start their relationship with the majority church without diminishing their identity? Which are power conflicts, which are cultural conflicts. Okay, let's start. First of all, help me with your definition here of minority and then either church or churches, and pull it directly into.
Well, I was thinking about, for example, the deaf church. Hold on, we have an interpreting question. Bill, are you going to voice for her?
I will.
Okay. No votes yet, so go back.
I'll wait. I was thinking, for example, you have a deaf church, sort of a minority being small. There's also gay, lesbian churches, Hispanic or Russian church, different groups like that. It could be any race, ethnic, gender, whatever. So there are a variety of different churches that have their own identity or trying to find their own identity. So not really just one, and they're not the same. But there's a lot of similar issues.
Okay. In terms of continue or start, in terms of the deaf church, or where are they now? Are they starting or are they continuing? Just tell me a little bit about what is the history of the starting or the beginning of deaf churches.
It depends on which denomination you're talking about. It really varies. Different religions have different histories. But, for example, in the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod, has for a long time, maybe 100 or so years, has a history behind it. But also that church has a longer history of hearing people running things. But there are other churches, Catholic, also have a long history, but also run mostly by hearing persons. But there are newer churches, and oftentimes have less deaf who are involved in running things, but are by, for, and run with deaf folks. So there are different denominations that have different histories. I don't know if that makes sense, but do you want to add anything, Mary?
No.
How about just a little bit in terms of the history that you have gone through in Philadelphia, and so to give us a little of the context of this question for you, because you're right in the middle of this question in a very real way.
Well, I'd probably speak more from a National Council of Churches perspective for now. What I'm hearing and seeing from all the different denominations that gather, come together, is that 90% of the deaf community is, quote, unchurched. And the reason is that the churches have not been effective for them for as long as they've been. So the majority church is basically saying that we've been doing deaf ministry for 100 years or whatever. What's the problem? and deaf people themselves are saying, well, so what? It is not working. Let us do it our way. Let us be our own church. Let us use our own language, our own culture. Let us express ourselves spiritually the way we need to make those links and connections. And the majority church says, well, I'm not sure if you're doing it right. Let's monitor your
theologically,
progress.
The theology of it, is it, or the organization of it, or the...
Well, I think it depends on the denomination. Different denominations have different understandings and perspectives. It could be both, maybe. And probably both.
Okay, the next part is continue their relationship with the majority church without diminishing their identity. Okay, how can we know? It's a curious way in which you put the question, because in terms of some things we talked about yesterday and the role of majority and minority and the idea of identity, because remember we talked about there are a number of different, it could be subjugation, it could be, if they're all locked into a power condition where the part of maintaining a status quo is keeping it so that the majority's identity doesn't become threatened. And so the idea of change or development of something which is a minority group into something that has an identity is accepted by the majority as long as it doesn't threaten the identity of the majority church. One of the things that even threatens the majority is when the minority requests to have a relationship, and that's why it's interesting when you say continuers start their relationship with the majority church without diminishing their identity, because you can interpret that question there, T-H-E-I-R, from two ways. Either without diminishing the identity of the minority, which is one way to interpret it, but I think you're...
So where are you looking at? There?
T-H-E-I-R.
Okay,
I can interpret that in saying, so that the majority...
Could you stand next to the written language up there and point to what you're talking about?
Here. The church's continuer start, their relationship, okay? Now, the minority church is starting their relationship with the majority. Okay. Now, the question of diminishing identity, how do you wish to interpret this part? Diminishing the identity of the majority?
The minority.
Yes. But, and I suspect that was your intent. But to understand the question further, you have to recognize that if you read the question from the point of the majority church, okay, the threat is here. Yeah. Do you understand my point?
Well, perhaps we could repeat yourself.
Okay. Did somebody else want to try? Would somebody else try to interpret from what I had said? Take a different view?
I can interpret it from not interpreter standpoint.
Fine, yes.
My perspective of the Lutheran church that she's hooked up with is that I'm not sure they trust the quality of a person that they can't really evaluate or communicate with to carry on the standards that are set.
Yeah.
And because we can't really supervise and evaluate, yet they want to be called Lutherans or whatever, and now we're giving, they're asking for our, my name, and yet they're so far apart that I'm not sure I have the controls over all the others. That's what's so different about deaf stuff. Mm-hmm. Whether it's church or any other service-related thing. And so they don't want to disconnect. They prefer the mainstream.
Because it's simpler and easier, and it doesn't call attention to the margins of the church. It keeps things central. One of the other things that strikes me regarding the question of deafness as a minority status as opposed to blackness or gender or age or whatever is that precisely for that invisibility, the invisibility of the minority status, deaf people can come into a Lutheran church and can be half of the church and nobody would ever know. Especially churches where you don't sing or you don't have to talk or whatnot. But you could survive very well and be very invisible. And that's a threat in some respects to majority conditions. A threat because the differences that are being hearing and being deaf from the majority perspective, once again I keep trying to pull this question from, keep looking at it from the majority and from the minority perspective. From the majority perspective, the threat is precisely that, mm-hmm. of the invisibility. A lot easier to have a bunch of black folk in a white community, because I know when they're in there, I know when they're not, I can count them, I have some way of being able to evaluate all that kind of stuff. Deaf and hearing, much more difficult, because I'm not certain I can identify them. And then even scarier is to find out that inside of the deaf community, there are all kinds of gradations that some people can be profoundly deaf and some people can be recently loss of hearing. And also they're crossing from one status to another without any record of it, without notice by the majority. All things that are very threatening. So the question of relationship and identity is critical. Trust as a concept is one of the essentials of the notion of community. How can you be part of my community if I don't know and I can't identify you when you yourself see yourself as part of the minority? My notion of identity becomes threatened. So that's where that second part, the majority church without diminishing their identity, can be interpreted in both cases.
Wouldn't you think, although it's a simplistic view, since I don't have a background in this area, that for the majority church to allow a deaf church to use their own language and then to follow the rules of their culture would threaten their own identity because it's not like them and that they've lost power because they're not doing what the hearing world does. And that's what I see. That's my simplistic view of this situation.
Right. I was going to say something very much the same. I was thinking of one example, Lutheran Church, for example. Lutheran, Roman Catholic, Episcopalian, and other mainline churches tend strongly to be liturgical and deaf people who share the same theological beliefs, you know, would probably choose to express their liturgy in a different form. So the mainstream churches that have the authority don't really trust that minority church, when it is actually very similar theologically, and often similarly liturgically, even if the form is slightly different, and that can really throw them off. You're not using music, for example. What's wrong? You're not. You're sort of eliminating parts of the liturgy. I'm not sure if you're really doing it right. You know, I hope that's making sense. You know, the change of certain traditions or styles of the worship can become threatening.
Threatening can become threatening to whom? That's my point. I want you to finish that.
The big church.
See, I'm sorry I came in late, but I'm confused by the question. I grew up in a part of Minnesota where we had a deaf church 25 miles down the road, and the minister would come to our congregation and talk about what was going on in the congregation. And it was part of the Lutheran church. And it was just for people who were deaf. And so I guess I always felt that you were part of a majority. I mean, that church was part of the Lutheran church. And that it, maybe you didn't use liturgy, and maybe, I mean, to me last night the service was as powerful for me as if we had done the traditional Lutheran service. So I guess I wouldn't see that there should be a power struggle.
What's your experience of
that? Well, who are you pointing to?
I'm talking about, what's your name, first of all?
Jimmy.
Jimmy, okay. I'm from Minnesota.
Oh, Faribault.
Are you from Faribault?
Yeah, no, I'm from near Faribault.
Hold it. If we're going to talk,
we have to do it one at a time.
And we have to comply with the rules for deaf conversations.
One at a time.
One at a time.
Sorry.
Now, I don't know your names of the towns in Minnesota, so you're from where?
Fair. The town that the church was located.
Faribault?
Faribault.
Faribault.
Okay, there's okay. A sign for that.
Faribault.
All right. Okay. Back to the initial question. And let me go back to to Beth. What is your situation in Philadelphia? Are you considered to be
the situation? Oh, Bill, I did it too.
My situation is that I have a mission church, and the mission church is under ELCA auspices, and that church is growing quickly. 2/3 deaf and 1/3 hearing. And we started from scratch. Very naturally, actually. Decided what we needed to do to grow in spirit. And not what the traditional or hearing people thought. We pretty much just paid attention to our own needs. and developed our own worship style and liturgy, but we have the same theology, the same as the Mother Church. We, for example, you know, have thrown out music, and that means throwing out a lot of songs, too. We do a lot of drama, you know, like last night you saw. And some parts of the liturgy, you know, are very important to us, like sharing of the peace. Whereas the Hearing Church very briefly seems to do that, and it's not a big thing. But ours, we really go all out. And then there are other parts, you know, that we do differently than the Mother Church. But we still have the same, you know, word and sacrament and process, the same form. We do have the support of the Mother Church. And at the same time, nobody on the staff who really knows what we're doing. They know what I tell them we're doing, if that makes sense. Most churches have some sort of supervision or people who, you know, can keep an eye on things to make sure things are going okay. But in many ways, we're very independent. Even though we're in the middle of the...
My experience in deaf churches goes back to honoring the establishment of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod Mission Field in Deafness, which, as earlier Beth acknowledged, is over 100 years old. And it is, I was serving those parishes and found that when I went to like the Mary Martha gathering of women who would then talk about ministry at large, and we would have both the deaf and the hearing together, and we were very much welcome and very much a part of the large community. The difference was felt when the deaf would say to themselves, we know we're a subsidized church. Money comes from the Mother Church to help us have our church. We are not independent financially. We know that socially, economically, we are not able to provide our own financial resources and are dependent upon the Mother Church, that we are in fact a minority in that description and rely on the power of the Mother Church to finance the work that is being done in that arena. And like the, what is that? The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, the women's gathering. It's not Mary Martha, it's LWML.
Wait, yeah.
LWML, Lutheran Women Missionary League. There we are. And that's a national entity that comes down into the locals as well. And so the deaf women would go to the LWML conferences.
The deaf or the
deaf? And would request funds for the van, because the deaf ministry always covers a large geographical area to take the ministry into the homes and to do a circuit, if you will. And so the deaf, it was my experience, understood that they were a minority when defined by not independent by their own financial structure. Later, as my history in the deaf church, I recognized the difference in terms of they had started taking the English presented blue book or red book or whatever synod you're from, that book that the church uses to make the proclamation in worship and liturgy, and they would translate it and always had, the deaf had to make the accommodation to fit the hearing form. And that then, as they are evolving
and recognizing and strengthening their identity are now, like Beth was talking about, taking control of the form of worship. And through the negotiate or dialogue, fortunately Beth is a strong advocate for and leader in her church and able to convey, we're doing it right, and this is how we're doing it differently. And that is my understanding of that word minority, which is not to say it's apart from, which is why I liked how the questions all took back to relationship.
I am struck by that 90% figure you gave, because in St. Paul, where I'm from, there we have a fairly large deaf community because we have a technical college that has a strong program. And I have come into contact with kids that have come to our church whose parents are deaf, and they don't come to church. The kids can come. The kids who have the ability to hear are there. And I can never communicate with them. And I don't think there's a church in St. Paul for them.
Deaf have a long history of being burned by the church. Not necessarily intentionally. But being told that they must do things a church's way. And often deaf are stuck in churches growing up, hearing churches growing up, sitting with their parents, just looking forward, not understanding, and being told just stay quiet, pay attention an hour and a half. And they become, you know, identify God as a God for hearing people and not for deaf people. And God really can't communicate, quote, with me. And faith comes from hearing the word of God. And so deaf just get fed up. And by the time they graduate from school, that's just it. See you later. Not involved with you anymore. Put up with that long enough. I'm not going to be hurt anymore. So 90% of the folks out there hate the church or don't know anything about it.
When I was in church before, before I went to the one with these two, he interpreted when I first arrived at that church. They were beginning that church. But before that, I didn't have an interpreter for church. So it was really, really hard for me to understand what was going on. Even though I am hard of hearing, I cannot understand everything about Pastor said. So it's better to have an interpreter with the hearing church if a deaf person's there. So I feel even if they are hard of hearing, they need to be there, interpreter. Because I feel if hard of hearing and deaf are isolated by the hearing, then it's not fair to them.
What's the dynamic? What's the cause on the part of the majority part of the church to be afraid of or to fear the death?
Afraid?
Just a minute. Are you talking about the majority being afraid of the minority?
Yeah.
Yeah. So make sure that I have mine. Okay.
Yeah.
Let's just talk about that for a
minute. I'd say lack of knowledge. Knowledge and understanding. Oh.
Well, that's a big part of it.
Because of what Jennifer has identified as a need for the church to provide interpreters, money. Money's an issue.
Yeah.
I'm afraid I'm going to have to put out more money.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to pay for an interpreter now.
Can I just go to this part of the question that Beth put out here? Which are the power conflicts? Very quickly.
Money, Bill.
Yep, money.
Money is a reward. Okay, it's called reward.
Can you put like the dollar sign?
Okay.
So visually, I'll remember that.
So that for one of the ways in which we communicate power with one another is through this idea of reward. Dollar is one. If I have somebody who's going to sign, it's going to mean now we have to find that money from someplace else. But let's look at the other parts, the other descriptions of social power. Because then I think it will help expand the discussion a little bit more. Okay? Because one of the other aspects of power is the notion of legitimate power.
I don't know,
it's
very hard to find it.
Legitimate means by the law. And by legitimate means it comes from somebody who gets to make the law. Yes.
Would an example of that be a judge?
Precisely.
Has control over me if I've broken the law and I'm standing in front and they found me guilty and it's legitimate, it's
right,
that they're going to impose
the
a sentence on me.
Power to be able to go ahead to say, make a decision regarding youth. And the legitimacy comes from the community from which the power comes. So there's a connection. Legitimacy is associated with community.
Can I give another?
Sure, please.
Beth has legitimate authority in consecrating elements because
consecrating the elements. Consecrating.
Making holy the elements. For Eucharist.
Yes.
Because the church has given her that authority.
Has ordained.
No. Has given her that authority before or her ordination. She hasn't been ordained yet.
Okay.
So it's legitimate nonetheless. There they are. Okay.
Yes. And so yes, think about legitimate in terms of a judge coming from some power of the community. Another aspect of power that is key here is the notion of charismatic power. Okay. By charismatic simply meaning the ability to persuade or to alter somebody else's behavior. Not based on something that you are giving them as a money or as a reward. Not something that is legitimate in a community sense or a law sense. It is charismatic in the sense.
The mother church? Is that what you're referring to?
No. Explain it further, Beth, and get your question. Good friends.
Do you mean the mother church would have that charismatic power?
No. What I mean is the charismatic power can come from one individual. It can come from a group of individuals. There's a very strong discussion, for instance, in the Catholic Church right now about the notion of of primary groups, of small groups of individuals, as having the true charismatic concept, because we don't see it in large organizations. It comes from an enlightenment. It means that it is some kind of an enlightenment that comes through a God or through something else, and the ability to focus that power. And the charismatic power comes from places that is very threatening to people who are based on legitimate power. Because legitimate power, and let me give you an example from my culture, from my Catholic culture. The strength of the Roman Church is that we've got this line that started with Peter, and it keeps going down and down and down, and we've got popes and we've got bishops, and it is legitimate because we can go back and we can find out who ordained who, And so that is a legitimate strength. Now, the Catholic Church has got to deal with the notion there are charismatics who are not part of this legitimate power, but who have great insight and sway and power in addressing questions and issues of morals, ethics, theology. Okay? And so these two types of power are threatening to one another. If you have a main majority church, by saying majority, Hager, you are saying, quote, the legitimate church, oftentimes. One of the threats to the majority is that the minority church is going to have the ability to be powerful simply because of that ability to focus people's concept of theology, morals, ethics. And the question is the charismatic church a legitimate church? And so that's always a contest that's taking place. Okay. Now, there's also another, there's several, but let me just pull one more out. But there's also the concept of expert power. Expertise. Yes.
I just back up 1 second.
Okay.
I think a good example of the charismatic is, I think a good example of the charismatic is Beth's church.
That, I suspect so.
In spite of it being a deaf church, and in spite of the fact that the original pastor left and Beth ran the church, every part of it, the church service, the newsletters, even the deaf people kept saying, we're not a church until we get a pastor. And brought in three terrible hearing examples of pastors. And were actually willing to take each one on.
Who was?
The deaf church. Because even they didn't see themselves as legitimate, even though they were. And had to go through a long, long process before they would even consider Beth. And the only reason they considered Beth is because they got word that she had applied to and had been accepted by the legitimate seminary. But there was a big transition now, because now they were saying, they were now in between, and they said, well, you know, this is a, she's not fully legitimate, but you know, there is a charismatic thing here. There is a natural bonding. Let's pretend she's sort of legitimate. So they're now at this in-between, feeling legitimatized by her course, but knowing it's what's going on that really is the real stuff.
Which is based on this, on the ability to persuade people, the ability to make people understand concepts that others cannot.
Yeah.
Which is precisely what charisma is. what charismatic power is. One of the things that makes the deaf different is that they are seen as having expertise that the hearing don't.
That's right.
And we don't.
Amen.
I was waiting for you to say that.
We don't.
That's what I want the Mother Church to recognize. You know, and they're starting to now. You know, our national headquarters is starting to say, yes, we need deaf pastors. We need hearing people who are very fluent with language and culture. We can't just accept less than that.
I have an interesting, this is kind of an aside, but it shows that we are waking up in Minnesota in education. We have standards that have been set aside. And we have a world language standard. And of course, you would think it would be languages of other countries, but we have had a group that has come forward to advocate for American Sign Language, and it is now part of one of our standards. It's part of the world language. And in our high schools now, we are offering sign language. And it has caused such a stir because we don't have teachers that can teach it. And kids are signing up like crazy. They want to learn American Sign Language because they see their brothers and sisters communicating and they don't know what they're saying. So I think things are changing.
And likewise, as I was saying at breakfast, this is a very same phenomenon at the university we teach at Duke, where ASL is offered as the second language requirement.
Mm-hmm. Good.
And is a very popular, I think the third most requested language, second language, in order to fulfill the university's fairly strict standard of a second language access.
But that's kind of how things are with our institutions, whether it be education or the church. When the people speak, we finally get our act together and we decide to make some changes. And so we as the people in the church need to be speaking.
What is ironic is that for a long time, ASL has been the second or third most used language in America, but unrecognized, not recognized, you know, behind English and Spanish. Mm-hmm. So it's somewhere in there. And now finally it's recognized. But deaf have been told for so many years that they don't have a legitimate language. And they never expected to be ready to be teaching at this level. And so all of a sudden there's a pretty dramatic shift and they're stuck. So there's nobody trained and available. And you know, they've been told you can't teach hearing people, you et cetera, et cetera. That majority power group works right now, trying to catch up with each other and understand mm-hmm. each other.
Let me just point out the last two aspects of social power, because you've alluded to them both. One is just the notion of information, gaining and the storing of information is power by itself. And It's different from the idea of expertise, which means the ability to in fact do and actually care out about. Simply the storing of the information and having it is seen as a position of power. In terms of deaf and hearing, one of the things that happens is the threat to the majority side, based on the recognition of the gulf between the minority and the majority. How do you make that leap in the 60s and in the 70s in the civil rights era, where the focus was on minorities, meaning blacks primarily? It was not so much an informational problem or even because there were paths of communication that they could interact with one another, and they could begin to share the information, or the blacks could share with the whites what it meant to be black, and the whites could begin to find better communication ways to share that block of information. So the gap wasn't that, there were all kinds of other barriers, but at least the gap of information. So for one of the phenomena here was that you had black studies, right? The rise of black study programs. Not black, which included black language, but it included black culture, it included history. It was uncovering a wealth of information that could be shared. The question regarding the deaf is, where would you discover that right now in terms of the majority, either the majority of the hearing or the majority church? I believe it's there. I mean, when I was first invited into interact with the deaf culture in Boston, Ree Phillips and Anita Small would bring stacks and stacks of literature and research that I had never even known existed, most of which came not from the United States, but came from interpretations from France, work done in other countries that had developed much more sophisticated long-term teaching with the deaf area and whatnot. But they were gathering the information. It was there. It simply didn't know it was there. And it wasn't packaged in a way that was immediately accessible to the hearing. So that's another aspect. And then there's one more. And then I don't mean that. Reference the idea that you can have power by knowing people who, by association, and the point of understanding referent power is kind of like the description that you gave of trying to find those first three pastors for the deaf church who were hearing. What the legitimate church was attempting to do was find somebody who had enough referent power. They were not deaf, but they knew enough about deafness that they would have the ability to go ahead and lead, persuade, change. The interesting thing about referent power, though, is that it is power which is given to an individual precisely because they stand in between two pieces. And the legitimacy or the acknowledgement of that power has got to be given by both of the sources. Mm-hmm. It's not good enough that it just comes from one side. And so the referent power is a very difficult power set, because it has to literally be in the balance of two. So, but once again, purpose for putting this out is simply to expand a little bit more the language and the concepts of how we talk about power loaded back into the complexity of that question. Yes.
And isn't that exactly the kind of power you have to have when you go in to mediate? You have referent power given by both disagreeing parties to come in and help negotiate through an issue.
Yes. I mean, that's where we'll put the referent power, and also referent power can be, it's a strange concept of power, because it can be by what you are not, again, you know, that you are simply accepted by both parties because you are not legitimate, because you do not have a reward to give to one another. Or as a result of the conflict or the dispute or the outcome of the dispute, you do not gain anything one way or another. That's a critical concept of power. Your expertise as a mediator is simply that of the process, not of the substance. So yes, but the referent power is the stranger. It's probably going back to what we talked about 2 days ago. The power of the stranger is precisely that. It is the notion of referent. Yes.
If I can just add one more thing that I think fits in there.
Sure.
Is that there still are a large number of deaf who feel holding back. They don't want to share their history, their language, their culture. They want to keep it. Save it. They don't want to give it out and then have it taken advantage of by that power church, power whatever. They don't trust. And I can understand that. And sometimes I feel the same. You said at the beginning that trust is involved. And it's not 100% happening yet.
Can I just mention trust briefly? Because it's a conundrum. It's an enigma. Yes.
If I can add something to what she said before you, I think an issue of letting deaf people who've been looked at as not able and as children to, you know, just as in some ways black people were not able and they needed to have other people, to give people control is a major issue. And what we find in our work oftentimes in giving up the power, one of the hardest things to do is to go out and teach hearing people sign language. Because you know damn well what's going to happen. Those bastards are going to go to their companies, and they're going to go to their schools and churches and become the experts. And you're like, dare I give out any of that information? Not for fear of misuse, for knowledge of misuse. And then when there's a mental health issue, you have to go to the mental health source, and you know who's there? That person who just took that beginning sign language class is now the case manager. And there's just too many of them out there. And so you go, and where do you start? And so you want your own deaf church, you want your own deaf school, and part of it's protective, and you know that you can control your own quality. And once it goes outside there, you know, and that happens over and over again, so the idea of withholding and trust may definitely come hand in hand.
I see some parallels in business. The legitimate power I see in the organizational chart.
Yes, that's normally
it's position power. The charismatic is the informal leader that is in some organizations viewed as a thorn in the side and something to be put up with or try to at best control. There's a new movement in business called transformational leadership, which tries to upset that paradox, tries to create a paradox around that. And actually proselytizes that you tap into the charismatic demeanor, that you have those characteristics of a charismatic leader before you get legitimate position power. That if you have to resort to position power, it's less effective, it's not as good, and it's a way of folding the charismatic or the informal leader into the organization itself. And maybe that's the step that has to be taken, is the folding in of the deaf within the majority, in tap into the informal deaf leaders and into the majority position.
The question you're raising is a very traditional one. It's the difference between the notion of segregation, assimilation, mm-hmm. and amalgamation. Okay, let me just go through those real quickly. Mm-hmm. Because the irony of segregated cultures is that the minority has a real reason to remain the minority. There is a positive, oftentimes a very strong positive relationship, not to allow the majority. When traditionally we think of segregation as something that the majority does to the minority, there are all kinds of social dynamics that make it a very positive thing for the minority to be able to remain. I mean, and your example is exactly there. Because what's the next step? Well, the next step is to be assimilated, meaning I have lost my identity as the minority, and the majority now has kind of swallowed me up and made me invisible. Because I don't have the ability to amalgamate, meaning where both the majority and the minority lose their identity and create something different. There have been times, and I think yesterday you brought the example of Martha's Vineyard as an example of having hearing and deaf live in a community where amalgamation happened specifically because that notion of what it meant to be deaf or hearing got blurred. It wasn't that you were no longer hearing or that you were no longer deaf. It simply was not a critical measure. And so it simply fell away. And you had something else come that was, I don't know what you wanted to find, but it was one of those examples. So I simply wanted to highlight that oftentimes peculiar, and you don't think about it, of the need for the minority to remain that and the danger involved. My very last point that I wanted to make, the notion of trust is a critical one. And it's critical for an odd reason, in that there is very little for a very positive purpose for the minority to have to trust the majority. And I argue strongly that it is not in the best interest of minority to trust the majority. I work with people who negotiate with one another. And one of the difficult things to be able to get people to recognize is that when you're negotiating, and if you think of minority and majority as a negotiating event, they are in fact interacting with one another strategically, attempting to find ways to exchange and assess mutual interests. That's kind of the definition of negotiation. In the context, in the arena of a negotiation, trust is seldom a positive event. It is more times than not a negative. The reason for that is when you trust somebody else, you are giving up the ability to test the purposes or the assumptions of the other party. And you are saying, I will trust that you are going to act in my best interest. You have made a whole series of assumptions that are going to harm you. Number one, you're assuming that the majority has the information about you so that they can make decisions on your best interest. You're assuming that the majority truly understands what your wants and needs are, and that can appropriately interpret it. What you have to change is this notion of trust to the notion of reliability. And it's just not a shift of words, because it's conceptually very different. Reliability means that you do not hand off your power. You do not invite other people in to go ahead and now share that information that you have, unless you have got some clear history that they can do with that piece of information according to what's in the best interest of you, the minority. There has to be a track record. There has to be. In the absence of that, simply coming in and saying, I am legitimate in the power, and therefore, because I'm legitimate, you now have to trust me. Get out of there. Get out of the situation. It is not in your best interest to do it. The difficulty is we try to build communities, and communities are good, and communities are based to some degree on trust. That's wonderful. We have to run our lives that way in order to trust on one another. But in the negotiating event, where power now is the thing that becomes exchanged, okay, just think of negotiating only in that respect, where power is the thing being exchanged, you have to drop that idea of trust in order to be able to be successful. You have to drop, and that by itself becomes difficult, especially when the majority is saying, if you're going to be a good Christian, you have to trust me. To which you say, sorry folks, it's not my idea of Christianity.
I couldn't hear you.
It's not my idea of Christianity. Because you have to earn that according to my definitions, not yours. I know we're 10:30. We can stop at that point in time.
That would close that beginning negotiating time, wouldn't you have to say, we'll come back tomorrow.
we're over.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, that's why my hands.
Beth says, do you want to say tape stop?
Yeah, tape stop. Stop tape. Tape stop.
Buy that tape.